The lights went out in the nameless bar just after 9. I was bent over the pool table with one hand in the bald patch behind the D, which Flynn the barman claimed was beer, but which was the same size and shape as Mrs. Flynn the barman's arse, nigh on a yard in the beam and formed like the cross-section of a cooking apple. The fluorescent over the table blinked out, then came back, and the glass-fronted fridge gave a low, lurching hum. The wiring buzzed, and then it was dark. A faint sheen of static danced on the TV on its shelf, and the green exit lamp sputtered by the door. I dropped my weight into the imprint of Mrs. Flynn the barman's hands and played the shot anyway. The white ball whispered across the felt, came off 2 cushions, and clipped the 8 cleanly into a side pocket. Doff, doff, chk, glonk. It was perfect. On the other hand, I'd been aiming for the 6. I'd given the game to Jim Hepzibah, and any time now when the power came back and everything was normal in the nameless bar, I'd pass the cue to my hero pal Gonzo, and Jim would beat him too. Any time now. Except that the lights stayed out, and the hollow glimmer of the TV set faded away. There was a small, quiet moment, the kind you just have time to notice, which makes you feel sad for no good reason. Then Flynn went out back, swearing like Billy-O, and if your man Billy-O ever met Flynn, if ever there was a cuss-off, a high noon kind of a thing with foul language, I know where my money'd be. Flynn hooked up the generator, which, God help us, was pig-powered. There was the sound of 4 large, foul-smelling desert swine being yoked to a capstan, a noise pretty much like a minor cavalry war, and then Flynn let loose some of his most abominable profanity at the nearest porker. It looked as if it wanted to vomit and bolted. The others, perforce, followed it in a slow but steady progression about the capstan, and then pig number 1 came back around, saw Flynn ready with another dose, and tried to stop. Lashed to the crosspiece and bundled along by its 3 fellows, it found it couldn't, so it gathered its flab-covered self and charged past him at piggy-top speed, and the whole cycle accelerated until, with a malodorous oinking crunch, the generator kicked in and the television lit up with the bad news. Or rather, it didn't light up. The picture was so dim that it seemed the set was broken. Then there were fireworks and cries of alarm and fear, very quiet but getting louder, and we realized Sally Culpepper was just now turning on the sound. The image shook and veered, and urgent men went past shouting, "Get back! Get clear!" and, "Oh shit, look at that fucker Jesus!" which they didn't even bother to bleep. In the middle distance, it looked as if maybe a figure was rolling on the ground. Something had gone absolutely horribly awry in the world, and naturally some asshole was present with a camera making himself 10k an hour hazard pay when he could have been rolling up his asshole sleeves and saving a life or two. I knew a guy in the go-away war who did just that, dumped the network's prize Digi-7 in a latrine trench and hauled 6 civilians and a sergeant from a burning medical truck, got the Queen's honour back home and a P-45 from his boss. He's in an institution now, is Micah Monroe, and every day 2 guys from the Veterans Hospital come by and take him for a walk and make sure the medal's polished on its little stand by his bed. They're sweet old geezers, Harry and Hoyle, and they've got medals of their own, and they figure it's the least they can do for a man who lost his mind giving a damn. Harry's kid was in the medical truck, you see, one of the ones Micah couldn't reach. We stared at the screen and tried to make sense of what was on it. It looked, for a moment, as if the Jorgman pipe was on fire. But that was like saying the sky was falling. The pipe was the most solidly constructed, triple-redundant, safety-first, one-of-a-kind necessary object in the world. We built it fast and dirty because there was no other way. And then, after that, we made it indestructible. The plans were drawn up by the best, then checked and rechecked by the very best, and then the checkers themselves were scrutinized, analyzed, and vetted for any sign of fifth columnism or martyr tendencies, or even a serious and hitherto undetected case of just plain stupid, and then the contractors went to work under a scheme which emphasized thoroughness and adherence to spec over swift completion, and which imposed penalties so dire upon speculators and profiteers that it would actually be safer just to throw yourself from a high place. And finally, the quantity surveyors and catastrophe experts went to town on it with hammers and saws, lightning generators and torsion engines, and declared it sound. Everyone in the livable zone was united in the desire to maintain and safeguard it. There was absolutely no chance that it could imaginably, conceivably, possibly be on fire.